The information in this podcast is alleged and based on our understanding and research at the time of recording. We make every effort to ensure the accuracy of the information presented, but we cannot guarantee that all data is entirely accurate or complete. The opinions expressed herein are solely those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views of any organizations mentioned. Listeners are encouraged to conduct further research and consult professionals before making decisions based on any information provided in this podcast. For further information and full case files, including crime scene photos and case reports, please go to the link in our show notes. Viewer discretion is advised. Previously on The Stack Deck.
Had I not, as David's father, felt led to request and examine the autopsy photos, this critical evidence would have never been brought to light. Can you imagine having to examine your son's autopsy photos to obtain evidence, knowing full well he had been burned on over 90% of his body? This evidence alone cements the theory of where David was standing at the time the fire was started and the position he was in, which would have made it nearly impossible for David to have started the fire in the first place. To lose a son in such a horrific way and have law enforcement and the county attorney's office working against you, the level of corruption in this case will blow your mind. If you are into true crime stories, then consider a story that involves intentional omissions by two pathologists, a police department who not only planted a knife at the scene of an unnatural death, but we believe purposefully mucked up the entire investigation to protect the police. If overlooking a murder by fire and having all branches of law enforcement from Hennepin County actively participate in a cover-up of a heinous crime, if these are not high crimes committed by several public officials, then I don't know what would be. Welcome back to the Stack Deck podcast series, episode 2, The County Attorney's Office. In this episode, we'll be focusing in on Hennepin County Attorney's Office. We believe anytime there is serious misconduct by any law enforcement official, Hennepin County stacks the deck with their in-house experts, making it virtually impossible to hold them accountable. And it is Hennepin County Attorney's Office, we believe, that holds the key to why David's case was not properly investigated and prosecuted. You do not need to live in Minnesota to know where Hennepin County is. It is, of course, where George Floyd was murdered. The ensuing George Floyd riots caused an estimated $2 billion worldwide in property damage, caused protests in at least 140 U.S. cities and in as many as 60 different countries, which included all seven continents. In addition to the murder of George Floyd, as many as 25 Americans were killed during the protests. Could there be a more notorious county in the world? Think about it for a minute. This Minnesota county, with a population of less than 1.3 million people, causes such a commotion throughout the world that thousands are mobilized to protest and speak out. It begs the question, why? Why did all this chaos happen in the beautiful state of Minnesota? Why so much mayhem and destruction? Was it because of an over-aggressive Black Lives Matter? Was it caused by grifters coming to capitalize on the situation so they could loot? Or was it because of a decades-long history of no prosecution of police officers and the citizens of Hennepin County had enough? From 1999 to 2007, Senator Amy Klobuchar was the Hennepin County attorney. In a February 2020 New York Times article entitled "Klobuchar Ramped Up Prosecutions Except Against Police," it is stated that despite over 24 police-involved deaths, Klobuchar referred all such cases to a grand jury, which indicted zero. Ms. Klobuchar served for a total of 96 months. On average, during her tenure, every 4 months there was a police-involved death, and yet she took zero on professionally. Then there is the 24 years in which Mike Freeman served as a county attorney during two separate terms, which brings us to the George Floyd case. Who or what killed George Floyd? Was it the drugs and cardiovascular disease, or was it a knee pressing the equivalent of 92 pounds directly against his neck for over 9 minutes while he is lying on his stomach with his wrist cuffed behind his back? If you question the latter, I'd suggest that the average 46-year-old chubby white Protestant would not survive 5 minutes. You may not believe he was a hero, but undoubtedly he has become a symbol and martyr of the injustices against the black man, not just here in Minneapolis, but around the world. Keep in mind, the Minneapolis police initially described the situation, stating that Floyd physically resisted officers and, quote, appeared to be suffering medical distress after being handcuffed. It made no mention that Chauvin was applying the MRT on the 46-year-old black man's neck for an extended period of time. Despite extensive video footage showing the horrific murder, the county attorney initially stated to the press, "There is other evidence that does not support a criminal charge," end quote. But after riots broke out, all bets were off, brushing the George Floyd murder under the rug. This is where the relationship between the Hennepin County Attorney's Office and the Medical Examiner's Office becomes so important and obvious. On May 27, 2020, 2 days after George Floyd's death, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman had a private meeting with Chief Medical Examiner Andrew Baker, in which they discussed George Floyd's cause of death. It has been speculated by many that the purpose of the meeting was to possibly influence the medical examiner to include and emphasize verbiage in the autopsy that would read, quote, "If George Floyd died at home, it would have been ruled a drug overdose." Keep in mind the significance and timing of this meeting. All the while the entire world is protesting what is going on in Hennepin County, the county attorney has no qualms secretly meeting with the chief medical examiner. So when Mr. Freeman met with the medical examiner, was he looking for, quote, "other evidence that does not support a criminal charge," that is, trying to get Chauvin off the hook, or was he attempting to accurately represent the rule of law? What we do know for certain is that this meeting violated basic protocol and Mr. Freeman was thrown off the historic George Floyd case by the presiding judge. What have we learned so far about Hennepin County Attorney's Office? We've learned that during the turbulent 8-year term of Amy Klobuchar, she declined to take even one of at least 24 police-involved deaths that occurred on her watch. Makes you wonder, had any of these 24 cases been handled by the county attorney's office, would there have been the murder of George Floyd and the ensuing riots throughout the world in the first place? And then there is the questionable conduct of Mr. Freeman and his initial involvement in the George Floyd case. To have the sitting judge boot him off the highest profile civil rights case in U.S. history because of a secret meeting with the chief medical examiner, all the while there are protests throughout the world, should speak volumes to the listener to who and what we're up against. As I stated earlier, to lose a son in such a horrific way and then to have the county attorney's office working against you, the level of corruption in this case will blow your mind, so please keep listening. Before we discuss what I believe is serious misconduct at Hennepin County Attorney's Office, let me first quote some of the basic standards or best practices set forth by the American Bar Association regarding the responsibilities of a prosecutor. The prosecutor is supposed to be an administrator of justice, a zealous advocate, and officer of the court. The prosecutor's office should exercise independent judgment in the performance of the prosecution function. The prosecutor generally serves the public and not any particular government agency, law enforcement officer, or unit. The prosecutor does not represent law enforcement personnel who have worked on a matter and shall law enforcement personnel are not the prosecutor's clients. The prosecutor should not make a false statement of fact or law or offer evidence that the prosecutor does not reasonably believe to be true to a court, lawyer, or witness. The prosecutor should act with diligence and promptness to investigate. In communicating with witnesses, the prosecutor should know and abide by law and ethics rules regarding the use of deceit and engaging in communications. The prosecutor should interview all witnesses. A prosecutor should evaluate all expert advice, opinions, or testimony independently and not simply accept the opinion of a government or other expert based upon employer, affiliation, or prominence alone. So with these basic ABA standards in mind, let's review how Hennepin County Attorney's Office handled David's case. After we received the autopsy and the state fire marshal's report, I contacted Hennepin County to speak with someone about David's case. I was referred to a senior Hennepin County attorney, Ms. Tara Ferguson, whom my wife and I met with on June 7th, just 5 months after David's passing. As a county victims advocate listening in on our nearly three-hour meeting, my wife and I heard some absurd rebuttals to our concerns. Here are a few that stand out. Absurdity number one. The maintenance worker could have stood in the hallway to put out the fire. Because the police refused to allow David to be rescued, we asked the obvious question, why didn't they allow the fire and rescue people to go in and try to save David's life? My wife commented, the maintenance worker went in and put out the fire and he wasn't attacked by David. To which this senior attorney responded, oh, he, the maintenance worker, didn't have to go into the apartment to put out the fire. He could have stood in the hallway. Even a casual glance at the apartment photographs shows that this would not be possible. And when we looked at the autopsy photos, we learned that David had green fire extinguisher residue on his body. This evidence lines up perfectly with where the maintenance worker says David was walking when he sprayed him with the fire extinguisher. So yes, the maintenance worker did enter the apartment, put out the fire, saw David, and shot him with the fire extinguisher, and was never attacked.
Had he gone into the apartment?
Yes. And that's not only really his breathing problems, he's got whatnot, so get out of there, you know. Sure. He already shot off the fire extinguisher. Of course, there was a fire on the stove. When I got in there, there was no fire on the stove.
Okay. And was there any fire anywhere when you went in?
Yes. I seen not a very big spot, but it was right there at the dishwasher. But I think we pretty much had the fire out before the fire department got there.
Did you make a statement to the police of the whole incident, or did you just basically clear out of there?
I cleared out of there. They never asked me for any type of statement, really, whatsoever.
Absurdity number two. When discussing Miss X's culpability, Miss Lopez stated, quote, she did everything right. She pounded on the neighbor's door screaming that there was a fire and she called 911. The facts are, if she had reviewed the case with any degree of seriousness, she would have noticed several problems with Miss X's testimony and actions. Miss X did pound on the neighbor's door, but she did this as she is running away from the scene. She also gave false information to me at the hospital as well as to members of the police department stating that, among many other damning statements, that David locked the door after he pushed her out of the apartment. At the time of our meeting, the senior attorney would have known the door was not locked. As was clearly stated several times in the police report, she had in her possession. Running away from a fire that, according to her testimony, she had not witnessed but only saw, quote, a whiff of smoke coming from underneath the door, does not seem like the actions of a spouse who is wanting to save her mentally ill husband's life. Moreover, why would she run out the back door believing there was going to be a really big fire when at that point all she had witnessed was a whiff of smoke? It does not make sense. These questions alone should have caused serious concern for the county attorney's office, but it didn't. Ms. X should have been interrogated on these two problems alone. She never was. Absurdity number three, she did everything right. She called 911. After Ms. X pounded on the neighbor's doors, that neighbor immediately called 911. At the same time, this neighbor's roommate came walking down the hall from the laundry room and asked Ms. X what was going on. When he was eventually interviewed by the state fire marshal 6 months after David's passing, he stated that, quote, it didn't look like she had thought about calling 911 until I asked her if she had, end quote. It is at this point, almost exactly 1 minute later, Ms. X calls 911 and is speaking with the dispatcher as she has traveled down three flights of stairs and is now heading out the back door. The average person can cover quite a distance in 1 minute. So yes, Ms. X did call 911, but it was 1 minute after the neighbor did, and who knows if she would ever called had not the next door neighbor told her to. Either way, this should have been another red flag for investigators. It's another indication that Hennepin County had no interest in finding out the truth. Absurdity number four, the missing lighter. Ms. X states on several recordings that she wrestled a lighter out of David's hands on two separate occasions, only for David to regain control before he pushed her out of the apartment and then started the fire. This lighter, however, was never found. When my wife and I inquired what could have happened to it, especially since all three investigative agencies on the scene did not find it, the senior Hennepin County attorney suggested that, quote, maybe David threw it out the window, end quote. Stop and think about this for a minute. Is this senior prosecutor really suggesting that after starting himself on fire, in which David was burned on over 90% of his body, including his face, in which he suffered inhalation burns and his eyelids were inverted, does she really believe that given the severity of his condition, David then proceeded to have the physical and cognitive wherewithal to find a window in the extremely smoke-filled room and proceed to throw the missing lighter out the window? Really? How offensive can you get telling two extremely grieving parents such garbage? In preparation for a meeting, I'd compiled all the relevant documents, including a personal narrative that I'd planned to leave with her. Most of this information she would have had or should have had on file. At the end of our nearly three-hour discussion, I handed them to her, and she very distinctly and deliberately, with both hands, handed them right back to me. At the time, I remember thinking something like, I don't want to cast my pearls before you anyway, so thanks for giving them back to me. But now, as I reflect on it, it is clear she did not want any possible information that would conflict with what the Plymouth police were putting forth in their report. Why else would a senior prosecutor want to see if information provided by a father would shed light on whether or not his son was murdered by fire? Seriously. The fact that David's death was ruled a rare and bizarre self-immolation alone should have set red flags up all over the place, but it didn't. One of the last statements Miss Lopez said to me, referring to the police report, quote, well, we pretty much have to go with what they give us. Let's think about that for a minute. So if a police report is unscientific, contradictory, and absurd, the prosecutors are obligated to stick to it? Is that what she's saying? This does not match up with the basic standards for the prosecutor set forth by the American Bar Association, does it? A few days later, without any notification to our family, she declined the case. So how could she so quickly decline such an unusual case? What was her justification? Simply because Ms. X screamed for help and pounded on the neighbor's doors as she is running away from the scene, exiting out the back door? Or because Ms. X called 911 even though it was 1 minute after the neighbor did? Or was it despite giving false and misleading information to the arriving officers, including that David had tried committing suicide before, that he owned knives and was violent and would attack them if they entered the apartment, all of which could have easily been verified was patently false, nevertheless, these experienced prosecutors believe Ms. X's implausible story? And if I understand Ms. Lopez correctly, she must accept the police report, no matter how absurd, incomplete, and careless it may be. With just these few discrepancies and serious lies told by Ms. X to the arriving officers, it is difficult to understand how a senior prosecutor would be comfortable closing the case so quickly. As you can imagine, when I left the Hennepin County Courthouse that afternoon, I was livid. The next day, I reached out again to the county attorney's office, demanding to speak to County Attorney Mike Freeman. I was told that this would not be possible, but that I could speak to Ms. Lopez's supervisor, Alan J. Harris, who was then the head of the Adult Prosecution Division. For the next 2.5 years, I communicated back and forth with Mr. Harris, only to be let down time after time. Here are three of many reasons why we believe Hennepin County is directly involved in this conspiracy and cover-up. The locked door. When my wife and I arrived at the hospital the night of the fire, I asked Ms. X what happened. She said, among other things, David woke her up, told her it was time to go, and pushed her out of the apartment. I asked her, "Did you try to get back in?" To which she responded, "Yes, but he locked the door." Ms. X tells this same story to the Plymouth police and again repeats it the next day to my daughter and son-in-law. If the fire wasn't started until the door was shut and then locked, there can be no other explanation. It would be irrefutable evidence that David killed himself. What's interesting, and what you will soon learn, is that the Plymouth police knew all along the door was never locked, but they ran with it anyways. And why would they do this? Because if it was believed and never questioned, it stops in its tracks any further inquiry into David's tragic death and why they made no attempt to rescue him. On Monday, following David's passing, I spoke with the lead investigator, Heath Bird, and he told me with confidence that, quote, "No, David pushed her out and then locked the door," end quote. If this is true, then there can be no other explanation to David's cause of death. I was now going to have to accept that my chill's son, David, took his life by self-immolation, one of the rarest forms of suicide. So with such strong evidence of suicide, it came as no surprise that when my wife and I met 3 months later with Ms. Lopez, she repeats the same so-called concrete evidence that David locked the door. And then again, 6 months after our meeting with Ms. Lopez and 10 months after the fire, in a recorded phone conversation, the first question the head of the Adult Prosecution Division, Mr. Harris, asked me is, quote, "Well, apparently, correct me if I'm wrong, but the police did say the door was locked when they got there, didn't they?" Here is the audio clip of that discussion.
"Well, correct me if I'm wrong, the police did say the door was locked when they got there, didn't they?"
"No, they did not. Maintenance workers, they opened the door, it was open, and that's in their testimony."
The door must have been obviously locked, right? After all, when you have the lead investigator and two senior attorneys saying so, it must be the case. Keep in mind how important this evidence or lie is. If it is believed, then there will be no questions to why they didn't rescue David. No questions about what happened to the missing lighter. No questions on how could the maintenance worker come from the first floor and get to the third floor so quickly after being woken up by the fire alarms, all the while Ms. X is still running down the hallway, heading out the back door. And not to mention, no question about the obvious and criminal planting of the knife by members or a member of the Plymouth Police Department. Fortunately, 2 months after our meeting with Ms. Lopez and 2 months before I spoke with Mr. Harris, the maintenance worker, unknown to them, was interviewed by myself and the state fire marshal. Here is some of what he had to say.
"Do you have a key to open the apartment, or was the apartment door open?"
"No, apartment door was open."
He opened the unlocked door and did not have a key to open it anyway. He put out a small fire around the dishwasher, saw David coming from the bedroom, heading to the living room, and shot him with the fire extinguisher. Had to get out because of the heavy smoke. The maintenance worker then proceeded to exit the apartment, leaving David behind, severely burned with the door closed in the dark, smoke-filled apartment. David would remain in the apartment for a total of 38 minutes while the fire and rescue people remained outside the door, not allowed to go in to try to save David's life. So how could so many experts get it wrong, believing the door was locked? Imagine after waiting 32 months for the police report, and we learn that there are at least 11 references in that report stating that the door was unlocked when the police arrived. It begs the question, if the police report does not say anything about the door being locked, where did Byrd, Lopez, and Harris come up with such information? After all, it was Mr. Harris who wrote in an email, quote, "I'm not able to speak for or explain the actions of the police department other than to the extent they are reflected in the police reports." How do all three highly trained professionals misread a document which clearly states 11 times the door was unlocked? Unless, of course, they were conspiring against truth and justice for David. Based upon what you have learned so far about Hennepin County, do you think this is an indication that the police report was altered to backtrack on their false narrative and cover-up? Had not the maintenance worker been interviewed and this valuable information had not been brought to Mr. Harris's attention, would the police report read differently? When you learn of the number of discrepancies in David's case, it is hard not to believe the worst. Which brings us to the pristine knife. On November 20th of 2018, a few weeks before our telephone conversation, I emailed my concerns about the conduct of the Plymouth Police Department to Mr. Harris. One of the most obvious problems with their investigation was the presence of a pristine knife that was placed near a chair where David had been sitting. Here is all he had to say about the pristine knife in a recorded conversation. Well, you're going to have to remind me. I remember the knife thing, but I don't remember what the police said about that causes you to say that they were not honest about it. Here's the recording.
"And lastly, then there's a, what I would call a pristine knife near the chair where David was sitting.
Mm-hmm.
There's evidence that that knife was moved after the fire, and it's sitting there on the floor. If David touched it, there would have been flesh and blood on it, and there wasn't. And this is just a whole pattern from the Plymouth police of not being honest about this."
"Well, you're going to have to remind me. I remember the knife thing. I don't remember what the police said about that. It causes you to say they were not honest about it."
"Well, they didn't say anything about it, but it's in a picture, and they say, what's the justification for believing David was lying in wait then? What's the justification for that?"
I don't know. I have to be honest and say I don't recall reading that exact language."
If the police didn't say anything about the pristine knife, then is everything okay, according to Mr. Harris? If it was a gun instead of a knife and the police didn't say anything about it, then still no problem? Common sense would tell you that since there was no soot or blood on the knife, it was moved after the fire was put out. Clearly, all agencies wanted to present it as significant evidence since all took several pictures, over 20. Clearly, this was a weak attempt to match the knife up with the false narrative that was originally put forth by Miss X. That is, David owned knives and would attack them. And when David came out of the apartment after the windows were shot out, burned on over 90% of his body, all the while the police had refused to allow the fire and rescue people to rescue David, they needed to plant a knife to make it look like David was indeed a threat, and the best thing they could come up with was a serrated kitchen knife. In addition to common sense that told us David could have never touched this knife, we had a forensic scientist examine the photographs. Here is what forensic scientist J.D. Thomas had to say. Quote, "It does not appear there is smoke or soot or any other fire debris or remnant on the knife. Even after enlarging it, I still can't see any debris. There appears to be a void pattern in the knife block, which looks to be where the knife sharpener was. This would indicate that the knife and knife sharpener were in place at the time when the soot was deposited, end quote. In other words, the knife was placed on the floor after the fire was extinguished, and it couldn't have been David. Could it be more obvious? Shouldn't this be a major concern for a senior prosecutor investigating a possible murder by fire and a police cover-up? Mr. Harris doesn't seem to blink an eye. Planting a knife and tampering with evidence at the scene of an unnatural death are very serious matters, and Mr. Harris should have immediately recognized it and taken action. Was he willfully gullible or turning a blind eye to a felony committed by a police officer? You tell me. Now to the phone records. Once again, during our December 12th of 2018 phone conversation, Mr. Harris agreed to get the phone records. 2 months later, on February 12th, Mr. Harris states that David's phone records had been obtained, but he still was waiting on Miss X's. On April 12th, he states that, quote, the phone records have not been received. I will push for that next week, end quote. On May 1st, he writes, I have not received the additional phone records. Sometimes we have to renew our requests, which I've done. I can't explain it, end quote. On May 15th, he writes, the delay in receiving phone records was caused by a change in service provider, which we learned 2 or 3 weeks ago. The correct provider has been identified and we await their response, end quote. And then finally, exactly 1 year after Ms. Lopez had originally declined to prosecute, on June 13th, he confirms, quote, I have now received the phone records that have been so elusive. My colleague and I have identified some investigative steps to be undertaken and are in the process of that follow-up, end quote. On February 7th of 2020, 14 months later and 2 years after David's death, since there is no mention of the phone records in the police report, I inquired in an email, quote, was there any activity on Miss X's phone during the time she said she was sleeping? Was there any other information obtained from the phone records that is relevant to this case? I asked. Over 5 months later, finally, Mr. Harris answered this question. He responds, quote, this material I have in my office, but my recollection is no. That's it. Included in the police report was a copy of a search warrant for the phone records. Based upon Mr. Harris's convoluted response, it is reasonable to believe this search warrant was never executed, another reason why an independent prosecutor should be appointed to this case. Finally, after nearly 2.5 years, Hennepin County releases their basis for ruling David's death a suicide. There had been more than enough time to complete a thorough investigation. When you factor in that there were 2 pathologists, 2 CSI agents, 2 fire experts, and 2 senior prosecutors all working the case, a careful scientific conclusion would be rendered, you would think. So with so much brain power and expertise, let's see what Mr. Harris has to offer our family to why Hennepin County is so confident David took his life by self-immolation. On July 27th of 2020, Senior Prosecutor Al Harris writes, quote, there are a number of factors. Point one, David had significant mental health issues. He had been prescribed risperidone, which is used to treat major mental health disorders, end quote. Yes, David was suffering from mental health issues, but had never been violent or suicidal in his entire life. Even 2 weeks before his passing, in 2 separate interviews, Miss X states that David had never been suicidal or violent. So why would Miss X state the opposite to the arriving officers? Shouldn't this concern Mr. Harris? Risperidone is commonly used to treat mental health conditions. Nearly 700,000 people in the U.S. are prescribed risperidone. They don't, however, end up killing themselves by self-immolation on the night before they're planning to move home to their parents' house and seek a divorce. Is Mr. Harris telling us that regardless of the evidence, all loved ones of mentally ill patients should forget seeking justice when there's compelling evidence that their loved one had been murdered? Would he tell grieving parents that even though a child was shot through the heart from 25 feet away, since the child was suffering from mental health issues, don't bother seeking justice? Clearly, there should never be such a strong prejudice against a person simply because he or she is struggling with mental health issues, and Mr. Harris should have known better. Mr. Harris's point number two, Miss X immediately told others he had lit the fire and she was asking for help, banging on neighbors' doors. This is true, and there is much more that should be said. When the two maintenance workers and a neighbor were interviewed by the state fire marshal, all three reported that as Miss X was running down the hall, they all heard her say David tried to light her on fire as well. Later, when she was interviewed, she denied making this statement. Of course, it would have been a lot hard to explain how David ended up engulfed in flames, but she didn't. As far as asking for help and banging on doors, Miss X took enough time to grab David's truck keys, hold the door open for the dog to get out, take time to bang on doors, but not call 911 until the neighbor tells her to, which she eventually does, but only as she is exiting out the back door, again, three flights down, and approximately 1 minute later.
My husband woke me up a little before 11, saying that I needed to go to my parents, that it was time, he kept saying I needed to go to my parents.
You were sleeping?
I was sleeping. Sort of sleeping, just laying in bed.
In your bedroom?
Yes, in my bedroom. I was kind of dozing off, ready for bed.
Where was he?
He, I thought, was in the bedroom, too, watching news, but I realized now that he was probably out in the kitchen. He came in, he was naked, saying these things. I got out of bed, I walked into the kitchen. He said, what's going on? He said, it's time for you. You need to go to your parents. You need to listen to me. I walked back into the bedroom to grab my cell phone. He came into the bedroom. He grabbed his cell phone and mine and took mine from me. And I said, well, I need my phone. He told me that he would give it back to me when I left to go to my parents. I said, okay. I went back into the bedroom to grab a shirt, and I started to hear a splashing sound. I took a step out of the bedroom, and I could see that he was dumping brown liquid, which was oil, over the top of his head. And it was at that point that I realized that the stove was on, the burners on top of the stove, where the light was lit up that they were on. And then I noticed behind him he had a clicker lighter he would use to start a grill or something like that. I ran back into the bedroom, grabbed a sweatshirt, and tried to grab the lighter from the counter, and I said, you know, you don't need to do this, it's going to be okay, just talk to me. He said, no, it's time, you need to leave. And I grabbed and he still had the oil up and some got all over my arms and my clothes. And I went into the bathroom quickly to rinse off the oil that was on my arms, ran back out into the hallway area, and grabbed my phone, started to yell, scream, help. He put his hand over my mouth and said, no, no, no. I was able to grab a key off of a key hanger that we have by the door, had my phone, my sweatshirt, and was able to get our dog to come out. I got into the hallway and shut the door, and I started to scream help again. There was a man that met me in the hallway, and they said, what's wrong? What's going on? And I said, he has oil. He's trying to start a fire. He opened his apartment door to get his partner out. My dog started to run into their apartment. I got the dog's attention, ran down the hallway, and while I was running, I dialed 911.
Instead of reasons to support suicide, Mr. Harris's statement supports reasons to further investigate Mr. Harris. But what is most concerning about Mr. Harris's statements is his confidence in his star witness, Miss X. simply because, as he writes, she immediately told others that David had lit the fire, we are to believe her? After all, did she not make obvious false statements to the arriving officers when she told them that David had attempted suicide before, had a violent history, and no knives? All of which is patently false and could have easily been verified had the lead investigator and the senior prosecutor spent 10 minutes reading David's medical records, in which Miss X herself states just the opposite, that David had never been violent or suicide. Why the change of heart makes you wonder, did the lead investigator and the senior prosecutor even bother to read this valuable information? It's incredible to think that the police were so scared by what Miss X told them about David owning knives and being violent that they set up a bunker in the doorway and positioned officers on each side of the door for their protection. Trust me, this does not reflect the history of my chill son David, in psychosis or out of psychosis. Why would someone who truly loved David and wanted to save his life give false information to the arriving officers about his condition? Accepting Miss X's statement as fact without fact-checking would be dumb and dumber. Miss X can bang on doors all night long. It doesn't change her actions and false statements.
The doctors that evaluated him couldn't find any evidence to support that he would be a danger to himself or anyone else. I supported that. He wasn't really dangerous to me. Within the first incident, he was just sort of angry with me about delusional things that weren't necessarily happening.
Harris, point number three. She did not have injuries as she might have occurred had she lit the fire. Let's be clear. Unrefined Bakken oil is not gasoline. It will generally produce a slow burn and usually takes a flame a second or two to light. There would be several ways for Miss X to start the fire without getting burned. Using a lighter would be an obvious way, which she said David had in his hand before he pushed her out of the apartment, but was never found. Lighting a towel or rag and throwing it on the floor under David as he was bent over the sink would be another way. Given all the inconsistencies and improbabilities, are we really to believe that since Miss X was not injured, this is a primary reason to rule David's death a suicide? Really? Harris's point number four, quote, David was asked to come out several times, but he did not do so until officers broke windows for ventilation. This is despite the fact he was clearly moving around the apartment. It would appear he had the ability to leave, but did not, end quote. Mr. Harris's statement, despite the fact he was clearly moving around in the apartment, is factless. Even a casual examination of the photo shows only one set of footprints leading away from the living room, and there are only one set of footprints leading into the kitchen and then back out. Keep in mind, the door was propped open when the officers were calling his name, which means they would be only 20 to 25 feet away from the chair where David, by all forensic indications, was sitting for the majority of the 38 minutes while he waited to be rescued. Clearly, the police officers would have heard David moving around and would have had some idea of where he was in the apartment. In their reports, however, they did not report hearing any noise, and they state they did not know where David was in the apartment. It is worth mentioning that the medical examiner, lead investigator, as well as the state fire marshal, all emphasize the same thing, that because David would not come out of the apartment and had supposedly been walking around in the apartment, this to them was the smoking gun. This was the definitive piece of evidence that proved David died by suicide. Did they even look at the footprint evidence? As far as why David didn't come out, let's think about that for a minute. For starters, David was burned on over 90% of his body. We believe David was heading out the apartment when he was shot by the maintenance worker with a fire extinguisher, which in turn sent him in the direction of the living room. Either way, getting shot with a fire extinguisher would have only added more confusion to David's already unstable and physical mental state. So if I understand Mr. Harris and the other experts correctly, The reason they are so confident that David killed himself is because he wouldn't come out of the apartment. This is despite the fact of David's horrific condition, despite the fact that the apartment was dark and filled with smoke. This is their conclusive evidence after 2.5 years. Giving this as a primary reason for ruling David's death a suicide should be an embarrassment to Hennepin County. Unfortunately for our family and its residents, I am confident this is standard procedure, simply another day at the office at Hennepin County. Harris's point number 5. When David came out and fell to the floor, he was directed to crawl toward the officers, which he did. I believe also this supports a belief he was physically able to exit the apartment before he did. Mr. Harris accepts the Plymouth Police report at face value, even when common sense begs to differ. Mr. Harris states it as an unquestionable fact that David was, quote, directed to crawl, and he did, end quote. The condition of his hands and knees do not support this statement. Mr. Harris and I discussed the autopsy photos on several occasions. He would be well aware of David's condition and should have known this statement from the Plymouth Police Department contradicted the autopsy photos. More importantly, what human in their right mind would ever command someone to crawl who was unclad and burned on over 90% of his body and had just fallen to the floor? What Mr. Harris leaves out is, in addition to being commanded to crawl, according to the Plymouth Fire Department report, David was also checked for weapons. And in the state fire marshal report, when David came out, it states that David asked for, quote, a drink of water. That's right. According to these experts, in David's condition, after struggling to survive for 38 minutes, he was commanded to crawl, he was checked for weapons, and then he asked for a drink of water, all of which are clear indications, according to these experts, David died by suicide. So in conclusion, here are the 5 reasons why Hennepin County concluded David died by self-immolation. Because David suffered from mental health issues and was taking risperidone. Because he wouldn't come out of the apartment after suffering horrific burns on his entire body. Because Miss X immediately pounded on doors and told others David started the fire. Because Miss X didn't have burns on her. And lastly, because the police say David crawled when commanded, even in his grotesque condition. These are the reasons Hennepin County and all their experts concluded David died by suicide. How many combined years of experience would you guess our 8 experts have under their belt to come up with such scientific conclusions? I estimated somewhere between 160 and 200. And then there's a question of their post-education. How many years did these guys put in? 32, 48? And then there's the money. How much are the taxpayers giving these 8 experts for rendering their invaluable services? $1 million, $2 million per year? It is difficult to imagine how such experienced and educated professionals would list these 5 points as critical evidence of suicide when there is so much more important evidence that cannot be easily explained away. It would appear Mr. Harris is desperate and grasping for plausible reasons for his shallow conclusions. Shouldn't he be more concerned about the window that was already open to ventilate before the officers arrived? If David had opened it after the fire was started, there would have been oil, flesh, and blood clearly visible in the study bedroom leading up to the window, but there wasn't. You would then have to believe that David opened the window before he purportedly started the fire on an evening when the temperature was only 5 degrees. Something no doubt Miss X would have had noticed on such a cold, frigid night. What about the fire alarms going off before Miss X exited the apartment? How else does a person who struggles with alcoholism, the maintenance worker, wake up and then get from the first floor to the third floor before Miss X is even 2 doors down, in which he overhears her tell the neighbor, "He tried lighting me on fire too," as she continues to run down the hall out the back door? This proves David was on fire before she exited the apartment. But wait, she did immediately tell the neighbors that David started the fire, so I guess this really doesn't matter. Does this make sense to you? It apparently does to Hennepin County. What about the evidence of a second pour, that after the fire was started, someone went and poured more Bakken oil throughout the kitchen? How else can you explain how the unrefined Bakken oil burned in one area and then distinctly and abruptly stops? I guess if Hennepin County can believe that after lighting himself on fire, then David proceeded to throw the lighter out the window, they will believe or grasp at anything. So we are to believe it was David who grabbed the jug of oil after he was severely burned and poured throughout the kitchen? Clearly, the evidence of a second pour should be significantly more important to Hennepin County than whether or not David was prescribed risperidone. What about Miss X not immediately calling 911? Instead, she took time to grab David's truck keys, hold the door open for the dog to get out, take time to bang on the doors, but not call 911 until the neighbor tells her to, which she eventually does, but only as she is exiting out the back door, three flights down, and approximately 1 minute later. This fact should cause Hennepin County far more concern than believing David had the ability to exit on his own free will, but didn't because he wanted to suffer and eventually die. How absurd. And what about the obvious and distinctive protected area on David's wrists? Our independent fire expert identified where the fire started, placing David as the, quote, item on fire in front of the dishwasher. This protected area on David's wrist appears to have an impression of the sink edge as well. Where else could have David been standing in order to protect his wrists? Add the inconsistent spill patterns on the countertop, the sink impressions on David's wrists, oil spillage directly below the sink, the missing lighter, and the only logical conclusion would be that David was hunched over the sink when the oil was being poured over him and when the fire was ignited. Most notably, Miss X places herself in this very spot. In a recorded conversation a day before the funeral, she states, quote, "I went back into the kitchen. I tried to turn the faucet on to spray this oil off of him, and he pushed me again," end quote. I cannot think of a way a human being could ever pull this off by himself, leaving behind no legitimate ignition source, getting no oil on your wrist while you are pouring it over the top of your head on two separate occasions. According to Miss X, and then being engulfed in flames and suffering major burns on over 90% of your body, but somehow this area on your wrists are miraculously protected. This is simply not possible. The facts are Mr. Harris's reasons for suicide are essentially baseless, not even plausible when you factor in all the other information. There is a reason God allowed this protected area to happen, and there's a reason why God prompted me to look at David's autopsy photos. Despite this strong evidence, in which many have said that if the roles were reversed and it was Miss X who died and it was David who was running out the back door, David would have been locked up that night. What is especially troubling is that we haven't even gotten to the Plymouth Police Report, the autopsy report, or the State Fire Marshal's report. Further evidence of a conspiracy, collusion, tampering with evidence, obstruction of justice, false reporting on an unnatural death, all of which leads to prosecutorial misconduct. Yes, it goes from bad to worse, but I believe the corruption is so obvious that truth will ultimately prevail.
On the next episode of The Stack Deck.
We believe any time there is serious misconduct by any law enforcement official, Hennepin County stacks the deck with their in-house experts, making it virtually impossible to hold them accountable. As I stated earlier, to lose a son in such a horrific way and then to have the county attorney's office working against you, the level of corruption in this case will blow your mind, so please keep listening. When my wife and I arrived at the hospital the night of the fire, I asked Ms. X what happened. She said, among other things, David woke her up, told her it was time to go, and pushed her out of the apartment. I asked her, did you try to get back in? To which she responded, yes, but he locked the door.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, the police did say the door was locked when they got there, didn't they?
No, they did not. Maintenance workers, they opened the door, it was open, and that's in their testimony.
Do you have a key to open the apartment, or was the apartment door open?
No. Was open.
I think we pretty much had the fire out before the fire department got there.
Did you make a statement to the police of the whole incident, or did you just basically clear out of there?
I cleared out of there. They never asked me for any type of statement, really, whatsoever.
Thank you for listening. As a listener, I know there's always ways that you want to help. And there's plenty of things you yourself can do if you feel the information presented in this series warrants a proper investigation by the DOJ and the FBI. You can do one or all of the following. First, tell your friends and family to listen to this podcast and sign the petition at change.org. The link for that is in our show notes. You can also call the DOJ at 202-514-2000 and call the FBI at 202-324-2000. 3000. You can also call your local investigative journalist and tell them about David's story. We believe that if enough people hear David's tragic story, the proper authorities will have no choice but to respond. Thank you for listening and for your support.